On this week's 51%, a study shows victims of sexual violence experience a stigma of silence that healthcare providers could help break.
You know, this is actually a critical part of what women may want to talk about, and if they don't want to talk about it, then, you know, you can sort of move on.
And a serious hiker is determined to stay on the trail with her family. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. No. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology recommends universal sexual violence screenings during routine visits. Although 1 in 3 women in the United States experiences sexual abuse, research has shown that these discussions often do not take place, and so scholars began to examine this aspect of reproductive health. 16 in-depth interviews with women who had experienced rape, molestation, coercion, or other forms of sexual violence, published in the Journal of Interpersonal Violence, show the extent to which survivors experience a stigma of silence in their families and communities, including doctors' offices. The study is an initiative of the College of Charleston's Women's Health Research Team in South Carolina, and scholars at Indiana-based Purdue University were also involved, including PhD candidate Stephanie Meyer in Purdue's College of Health and Human Sciences. She's corresponding author of the paper.
And so the research really started in South Carolina with a collaboration between a history professor, communication, so an interdisciplinary collaborative, to really understand women's life course experiences with their reproductive and sexual health. So we planned this project that was going to span multiple generations. We had an age range of 19 to 71. And so we really were interested in not just the public health and like the current health needs, but also those past experiences, how people sort of navigated that in their communities, in these different settings. And it really just started with this idea of wanting to understand the life course perspective of contraception, pregnancy, all of these things. How we sort of ended up examining the sexual violence component was really women were talking about it as part of their overall experience with their health. So they were answering questions about contraception or pregnancy or, you know, communicating about menstruation and things like that. And among the women included who divulged it, I don't know if everyone in our sample had these same experiences, but the ones who shared this, it was really part and parcel to a lot of their women's health experiences. And so we saw that a few times, and then we kept sort of hearing it and hearing people's stories about themselves, their families, their communities. And we, as a team, an interdisciplinary team, were like, this is something that is really contextually impacting on their reproductive health and the way they make decisions and the way they talk to people about their reproductive health, the way they sort of navigate it and make meaning of it. And so if that's important to women and that's sort of what their voices were telling us, then we wanted to be able to sort of look at that as something that is not necessarily always considered as a critical component of reproductive health for women. And that's really how that sort of came to be.
So what did you find then further that was either surprising, instructive, whatever, of course instructive, but whatever the case is, you know, what comes of this? Because from what you just said, I'm thinking, well, now it really falls on the healthcare provider to ask the right questions, to open that line of communication in a way he or she might not have prior.
Yeah, and so what we found was quite surprising, and I think the healthcare provider aspect of that was some of the surprising components of that, was that these conversations these women were talking about were not really being had at any level. Maybe their friends, as they grew older and decided they wanted to advocate for themselves, but it was surprising that these questions had never been asked either in their social circles or in healthcare provider appointments. And so when we were sort of probing these women as they were sharing on these topics, it sort of came to light that they would actually, you know, have liked to been asked by healthcare providers. They felt like they weren't comfortable maybe sharing, but there were things that they were sort of displaying that they noticed or that they thought back on later that maybe should have been inquired into by providers that wasn't really happening. Also, interestingly, is a few of the participants noted actually entering the healthcare system because of some of these sexual violence experiences. So if you can imagine, you know, if some of your initial, like, women's reproductive health care is based on you having experienced this trauma and then entering the healthcare system, it could change your sort of perceptions of what healthcare can do for you. And some of them described really, you know, good experiences where they felt listened to. But if you have women who are also not being asked these questions, like feeling heard, feeling understood might be more difficult.
How can doctors, nurses, you know, break the stigma of silence faced by, survivors of sexual violence?
Yeah. And I think that comes, of course, with understanding, you know, the need for trauma-informed care and for really this idea that people's experiences can impact their choices and their decision-making. But what we've sort of found as we've been engaging in this process and this research is that asking sort of these open-ended questions during an appointment, and maybe not from not in depth with every person because people may not want to share, but sort of opening the floor to having these conversations. You know, there's a lot of constraints sometimes, you know, time and getting to see different people and spend enough time. But asking these sort of open-ended questions rather than maybe just the checklist or offering a checklist maybe upon intake. And then if they check yes, you know, in a very calm manner, just saying like, you know, we have lots of women who maybe come in and have experienced something like this. Is this something that you feel, you know, we could talk about or might affect your choices? And sort of putting that power into women's hands to share that while also opening the floor. And maybe at that point they won't want to share, but maybe that trusting relationship of having been asked, from what our participants sort of talked about, like having been asked would have been nice. But putting that power in to then share at that point, share later if it arises, and really just broaching it in such a way that women feel they have a say in whether or not they disclose, feeling that they can and should share if that's something that they want to do, and really making it not, oh, like, why did you mark yes, or something that's more maybe feels more judgmental or accusatory. Maybe it's not, but maybe, you know, wording instead of why, oh, like, I noticed you checked this, or, you know, we have a lot of patients who come in and have had these experiences. This is something that would be helpful for you to share. And just sort of reframing how we talk about it and not just leaving it as like a check mark yes, if that's something that a woman wants to share and talk about as part of her reproductive choices.
How do you translate, how do you get this information to healthcare providers to say, look, these are what, you know, victims of sexual violence are asking for, that you ask, you know, that your practice asks? How do you get this information to them?
Yeah, and I think that's a critical component, the translating of these types of findings to practice. And there is an upsurge in a lot of the work on trauma-informed care. JAMA recently published articles in these areas about like the number of women who've had these sexual violence experiences or just patients in general, not just women. And sort of that has helped, I believe, and then with the Me Too movement. But really it is about understanding what is occurring in the clinical setting, you know, understanding the provider's workflow, how much time that they have to sort of talk about these. And then reiterating that this is not sort of an add-on. You know, this is actually a critical part of what women may want to talk about. And if they don't want to talk about it, then, you know, you can sort of move on. but really including that in training, a lot more training in medical school and in residency about like that these sort of maybe more socially contextualized questions are important, and making it so that it's sort of an easy addition rather than something that feels like a lot more cognitive effort or a lot more work in an already, you know, very busy clinical setting, to just be like, hey, here's some example verbiage for how to ask this question, and here is what you can do to follow up if someone needs resources, because referrals are critical. It, you know, providers have some of those resources at hand. They can direct that to maybe the nurse manager, the office manager, to sort of give those resources. But saying, you know, you as a provider are not alone in trying to figure this out, but it may impact how women sort of conceptualize their choices, what they might need, why they're choosing something. So it's a critical part of that investigating of the appointment. But also, you know, here are resources should they need a referral. So then it's not just like solve it yourself as a provider, but bring it up, make that an open space if that's something that they want to talk about. Here's simple verbiage to do that, simple communication strategies. And then, you know, you can always refer out for additional support.
You know, I'm wondering in terms of communication, and since this, you know, we're really talking about this stigma of silence, now that we're in this Me Too era, you know, and we have been for a bit now, are you finding that there is more of a willingness to talk, that, you know, seeing people in, you know, in the country and the world, for that matter, speaking up, whether they're famous or not, is that helpful? Has that been helpful?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it definitely has created sort of a movement where women are more, women and other survivors, are more willing to share these. And maybe while it's the stigma still exists, if you are, you know, the victim of a trauma or have experienced a trauma, there's still stigma that stems from social and cultural norms and community settings and structures. But it probably will allow women and does allow women to feel more comfortable divulging that, especially to people that they would trust, which healthcare providers, nurses, doctors, nurse practitioners, they're very trustworthy. Women patients often think that they're very trustworthy and they want to share and they want to have these trusting relationships. And so it probably does increase the comfort level of sharing this. From what our participants talked about, they wanted to be asked. It may change that women are more willing to just share if it relates to what's going on with them and what their choices might be in a reproductive health visit. And so seeing that, seeing others who seem like them, who've experienced those things, who are willing to share, provides sort of a model for how to do that and a model for how to do it and not feel, you know, as though you're changing someone's way that they, you know, it's like removing that like fear of, is what I say going to affect someone else? It's more so, hey, this is what happened to me. I need the resources. I need this to be considered as part of my experiences. I need, you know, assistance and referrals and things like that if it's something that's still bothering me. And so seeing those everywhere, you know, in the media, in the news, like in their own communities, as well, like that definitely would help to maybe increase some of the confidence in sharing and taking that initiative.
Is there anything else, Stephanie, you wanted to mention about the study?
I think just that, you know, we don't often consider a lot of the contextual factors in women's lives sort of impact how they make decisions, impact how willing they are to have conversations with providers, and can impact trust. I mean, in your provider, because maybe you have issues with trust with others because of certain traumas that you've been through. And I think that it's critical, especially in women's reproductive health, whether that be a primary care provider or OBGYN or anything like that, but across providers, to really inquire into some of these contextual factors that can impact what is a real choice for women and what maybe they perceive as their only options, because then we can make sure that we as practitioners, professionals, providers, can make sure that their needs are being addressed in the most effective and compassionate way possible.
I did want to ask Stephanie, did this study prompt interest in kind of piggybacking on this study? Was there something that while you were doing this said, oh, now I want to research X?
Yeah, some of the colleagues who are on this paper and I are currently doing some data collection with different providers and women on sort of the decision-making processes and how sexual violence can play a role in that, so from different perspectives in community settings. So places where women maybe have more access if they have, you know, different constraints on them to getting to a private office, for instance. So understanding that in some of the community health settings and understanding how sexual violence can impact that decision-making even more so. So like there are specific questions now that we're asking. And understanding it from the provider lens, too, because if we aren't sort of aware of what they're doing now or what they are hoping to do or what's worked for them, then it's harder to sort of, fit that into what they're doing. And so we are collecting data on that currently.
That was Stephanie Meyer, corresponding author of the study about a stigma of silence faced by sexual violence survivors. Meyer is a PhD candidate at Purdue University. One of French President Emmanuel Macron's new government ministers has been accused of rape. Another is a lawyer who ridiculed the Me Too movement and defended a top official accused of rape. Women's rights groups staged protests in Paris over the appointments they see as burying Macron's promises to make equality between women and men the great cause of his 5-year term. The French government said it remains committed to equality and defended the new ministers, stressing the presumption of innocence. This next story comes to us from Wyoming Public Media's podcast, Human Nature. Erin Jones introduces us to a woman who wanted to keep pursuing her passion after she had kids, even though nobody had blazed such a path before.
Cindy Ross loves to hike.
So I hiked the Appalachian Trail when I was 24, broke my foot, and had to do it in two halves. I moved to the Hawk Mountain Sanctuary area, which is along the Blue Mountain and the Appalachian Trail in Pennsylvania, world famous for migratory birds. And I used to stop in the little town of Port Clinton that the trail goes through and pick up hikers and bring them home and feed them. It's called Trail Magic. The year after I finished, my soon-to-be husband was hiking the trail, and I brought him home and fed him, and that's how I met him. By the time we were married, we both had hiked the whole National Scenic Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail.
When Cindy and Todd started thinking about having kids, they wondered how they could keep hiking long distances. It was the 1980s. Few people hiked these trails at all, let alone with children. Cindy found herself very pregnant on a panel discussion at a conference of long-distance hikers.
And I asked the 600 people in the audience if they had any advice on how we could keep backpacking, and no one raised their hand because they had either decided on purpose not to have kids because they wanted to keep hiking, or they already were so old that their kids were grown up and they just started backpacking.
Soon, Cindy gave birth. When baby Sierra was 6 months old, the family tried a short backpacking trip. The amount of weight they had to carry, with diapers and everything else, was unmanageable. It became even harder with the birth of their second child, Bryce.
So we were at this party, and I was complaining that we couldn't backpack with two kids, two babies, and carry all our gear.
Turned out, the man she was complaining to happened to be a llama breeder. And he said, "What about llamas?"
The Rocky Mountain Llama Association was trying to promote llama packing. He said, "I bet you they'll sponsor you, and you could do something like the Colorado Trail, which is 500 miles through the Rockies in that state." So Todd and I decided that we would do that. We had a 1- and a 3-year-old. We had 100 cloth diapers, and so we got llamas for free, all their gear. If you're on the AT or any other long-distance trail and you don't have stock, you would just stick out your thumb and hitch into town to resupply. But we couldn't do that with a string of llamas. So the whole 500 miles, they had to set up helpers so that we would be at a road at a particular time, and they'd be there with their llama trailer and take us home and feed us and help us get to the laundromat to do Bryce's diapers. We would have to, you know, dry the cloth on the bushes to evaporate it, so when we got to the laundromat, we could throw them in. And then dealing with the poop, we had to, like, dig a hole, have a disposable bucket. And in this area, in the Cacha top of Hill, Sierra, at three, she had, like, this like, procedure of going to the bathroom that she had to go and find a big log to sit on and, like, hang her little butt off the back, and needed two sticks to hook underneath the log as handles, and wanted to be far away for privacy. So she's, like, up on this hillside, this open hillside, going to the bathroom, and all of a sudden, all the llamas started going crazy. What they do is they have this horrifying warning call that they do, and they all look in the direction of danger. And they were all looking, like, right behind her. We just thought, oh, my God, she's up there going to the bathroom with her pants down, and there's a mountain lion behind her. What they do to little kids is they take their neck and they break it. You know, they're dead, and they can carry them away and eat them. So we raced up and grabbed her off of her log with her hiney still hanging out, and she wants to know what's going on. It's like, never mind, we're just taking you back to camp where you'll be safe.
After that summer on the Colorado Trail, Cindy and Todd knew they wanted to do more, so they took a year off for Bryce.
My husband said, we will not return until this child is potty trained.
When the kids were 3 and 5, Cindy's family began the Continental Divide Trail. It stretches over 3,000 miles across the Rocky Mountains from Canada to Mexico. Cindy's family conquered part of it each summer for 5 years, with llamas, of course. The CDT is incredibly challenging and remote.
One time, we spent a month and a half, and we only saw one person, and it was a cowboy riding the fences looking for breaks.
But most of the time, it was fun. They invited friends along. The kids loved playing outside all the time. And then they came to a ridge in Montana.
And so we were descending down into this saddle, and the saddle's like a dip in the ridge, and it was acting like a wind tunnel. So it was extremely windy going down into it, and then when we got into it, it was so windy that Sierra and Bryce didn't want to ride, so we took them off and had their hands in ours to hold on to them. But the saddle got blown off Sierra's llama, and he was flipping out because it was still attached, but it was hanging under his belly. So I couldn't control my llama, and I didn't want to let go of the lead rope because llamas are like cats. They will stay with you and listen to you as long as they're on a lead rope. But when they get off, they kind of want to do their own thing. And I heard stories about llamas being stuck up on the divide for the whole winter because they couldn't get them back. So I didn't want this llama to get loose and have to go through a lot to try to get him back. So I wasn't letting go of his lead rope, and he was freaking out because the saddle was underneath his belly. It flattened us, too. Sarah and I were laying on the ground. That's how windy it was. We couldn't stand upright. And Barrick was, like, stepping on us because he was just losing it. And I'm screaming to Todd at the top of my lungs to help us because I don't know where he is. But he couldn't even hear me, and he was just, like, yards away. That's how this wind was, like, this locomotive.
Eventually, Todd found them, and together they slowly edged around the back of the mountain.
And my son was 3 at the time, and he said, just kind of like sputtering, he said, like, you know, I thought I was going to die, Mommy, because I couldn't breathe. We're not super religious, but, you know, I think we're a spiritual family. Just to comfort him, I said, okay, let's just say a quick prayer to God to keep us safe. It was sunny and everything like that. It was like no sign of rain anywhere. And so we did that. And as soon as we did, this double rainbow came out in the valley. Bryce goes, wow, that's God saying that he heard us and we're going to be okay. And it's like, I guess so. So we crawled around the back of the ridge, and when we got to the saddle on the far side of this peak, it got windy again, and Bryce said, let's say that prayer again, because it worked last time. And so they did, and the rainbow came back. It was crazy.
In the years since then, as far as Cindy knows, nobody's done anything like what her family did on the Continental Divide Trail. Now, Cindy's kids are grown.
My daughter actually wants to get pregnant in 2 years, and she's already announced that we have to get llamas and train them so that her new baby will ride as soon as possible. So maybe the next family to do a long hike will be my own kids.
That was Cindy Ross. Her book about her children's unusual childhood is called The World is Our Classroom. The story was produced by Wyoming Public Media's podcast, Human Nature. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1618.